Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 13th of February, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Hanningson from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, we're going to get straight on with NATO. The NATO defence ministers are meeting today. This is 2 days of talks on what they're describing as pressing security challenges. Particularly Russia's violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Patrick, they will also be discussing deterrence and defence and NATO missions in Afghanistan, Kosovo, Iraq, and also burden sharing, which, this has been on the cards for quite some time because of Trump's statements a couple of years ago that the EU needs to step up with their defence spending. So burden sharing and NATO-EU cooperation are high on the agenda. So let's have a look at what Gavin Williamson had to say.
Underline Britain's key leadership role within NATO. We're making a further commitment of deploying 5 Apache attack helicopters to Estonia and 3 Wildcat helicopters to Estonia as well, underlining our commitment to peace and security with our NATO partners, meaning that Britain will have one of the largest deployments as part of the enhanced forward presence. Well, we've actually seen a consistent message sent to Russia, going all the way back to 2014, where concerns were raised with their non-compliance with the treaty. What we need to be doing is putting all efforts to ensuring that Russia comes into compliance. There is still a period of 6 months where they can have the opportunity to do so. But we then have to keep all options open as to how best to deal with this threat in the future. Thank you very much.
So Gavin is as charismatic as ever there, Patrick, but consistent message to Russia since 2014. They are out of compliance. We've had this conversation before, but it's worth just briefly mentioning it again. Russia, of course, argues that the West is out of compliance because of the so-called missile defense systems, which, as you've said on this program before, are a first strike weapon. And so it seems that if anybody's out of compliance on this, both sides are out of compliance. So what are your thoughts?
Well, firstly, I just want to comment on the gravitas of Gavin Williamson. I mean, he just he commands respect on the international stage, and he's really putting Russia and China on notice, and they should be rightly frightened by Gavin Williamson. Mike, yeah, you absolutely made a great point there. It's not just the INF Treaty. Russia's extended this conversation really to include the U.S. withdrawal of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002. So obviously Russia's looking at this conversation as framed in a much wider context. The West, on the other hand, is trying to frame this in a very narrow context. And not only that, but to reframe the actual first strike or counter-strike capabilities of the missile defense systems, which are now dotted along Russia's western border and also under its soft underbelly into Eurasia, Mike. So these are slightly worrying that this conversation can't be had in a way maybe diplomatically that had been had even during the Cold War. And I think it says a lot as to either the level or the low level of diplomacy or capability of diplomacy by Western diplomats and ministers these days. The standard may be lower, or they're just trying to position the West into locked into an aggressive stance, Mike, with Russia. And this isn't going to end with Russia, Mike. This is going to be extended also to China, to Iran. So they're really trying to build up a global threat, as it were, to Europe, when in fact, Mike, perhaps no threat exists.
Well, indeed. Now, Gavin Williamson there saying that Russia has 6 months to come back into compliance. And of course, this is because the treaty has been effectively suspended by the United States. And at the end of that 6 month period, if the US deems that Russia hasn't come back into compliance, and that, just so we understand, they're requiring Russia to verifiably destroy the missiles that are considered to be non-compliant. So if Russia doesn't do that, then the treaty ends. What do you think? Where are we at that point, just briefly?
Russia's not going to do that. They're not going to be dictated In this way, Russia has been calling to come back to the negotiations table and to talk about U.S. violations of the INF Treaty, and also to revisit the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. So I think, Mike, if you look at Russia's past behavior and you look at its statements in the United Nations Security Council and on diplomat stage, Russia has been consistently exhibiting normative behavior in terms of international relations. Conversely, the United States and Britain have been consistently exhibiting sort of rogue actor behavior, so not normative at all, and side-skirting international law at every possible opportunity, and in terms of the U.S., not even honoring any of its treaties or obligations or agreements across the board. So I think this is going to continue, Mike. Russia has no choice but to work within the international system to marshal its allies in this way. And the United States is locked into this foreign policy behavior, which is very aggressive, very unilateral, very unipolar in its outlook. So I don't see much change, Mike. What I do see is a new arms race. That seems to be where we're headed, is a new arms race. And then hopefully, I hope at some point, we'll come back to the negotiations table once again and perhaps sign a multilateral anti-missile or a new INF agreement.
Okay, well, let's stick with Russia and the United States. And RussiaGate, Patrick, it seems to, well, you've labeled it a flop.
Well, after 2 long years, the results appear to be in, Mike. This is from NBC News. The Senate has uncovered no direct evidence of a conspiracy between Trump, the Trump campaign, and Russia. So no Trump-Russia collusion. And there seems to be bipartisan noises, Mike, being made in this direction. So, you know, we were never going to find a contract signed in blood saying, hey, Vlad, we're going to collude, said one Democratic aide. So you can imagine, Mike, that this has just triggered all sorts of partisan back and forth comments here. But this is from Richard Burr. He's the Republican Committee Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee here. So we will write a report based upon the facts that we have. We don't have any, then we don't. If we don't have any, then that would suggest that there was collusion by the Trump campaign in Russia. So, and then this is being countered here by Mark Warner. This is the U.S. senator. He's the vanguard of the sort of Russia-phobic, anti-Russian movement on the Democratic Senate side. And this is what he says. I'm not going to get into any conclusions I've reached because my basis of this has been that I'm not going to reach any conclusion until we finish the investigation. And we still have a number of key witnesses to come back. So he's basically saying, oh, it's not over yet. We're going to keep calling people in and investigating people until we find some evidence, which is kind of antithetical to how normal investigations go. But there you are. This is Mark Warner. He, by the way, is the person who invented the whole Russian bot conspiracy theory and forced Facebook to sort of admit after multiple trips to the Silicon Valley that there were Russian bots running amok on Facebook when in fact there weren't. That's Mark Warner. You can thank for that. So they all have a lot invested in this conspiracy theory, Mike. But let's just look at the Russiagate flop. As you can see, there's Robert Mueller and the wide-eyed Adam Schiff flanking Mueller there. And 2.5 years of investigations and over 200 witnesses, 300,000 pages of documents, and approximately $30 million in U.S. taxpayer funds and counting. And the result is nada, a big goose egg, nothing, no evidence at all. So that's where we're at with this investigation, Mike. So,
but is it over?
No, they're going to drag it on. But Mike, the reality is, if there was any actual evidence, it would have been produced before the November election in 2016, because it would have helped Hillary Clinton. But unfortunately, there is no evidence, and there won't be any evidence. There'll be a lot of innuendos, and also maybe indictments, like we've seen with Roger Stone. Or other members of the Trump transition campaign who have been indicted and charged with process crimes that stem from the investigation itself and actually have nothing to do with the campaign colluding with Russia, Mike. So there could be more of this. The point of this whole Russiagate farrago is to extend it into the 2020 elections, and that therefore to hurt Donald Trump, to hamstring him, somehow weaken him into the election cycle. That's been the point of the proceedings all along.
Now, a couple of days ago, Elizabeth Warren made the statement that perhaps Donald Trump may not even be running in 2020 because he may not be a free man. Clearly, that can't be related to this. So is there something else going on as well?
Yeah, that wouldn't be related to the Russia investigation. That would be related to a whole raft of investigations that are currently being lined up by the newly controlled Democratic House, Mike. That would range from everything to his extramarital affairs and his tax returns and any business dealings. He may be going back, who knows how many years, 20 years or something like this. So they're going to basically try to jam up the system with a number of these efforts, and also articles of impeachment. If they haven't already been filed, they will be filed. I'm sure of it, and they'll keep this for the sort of the heart of the election cycle. Mm. So it's just to create doubt that this president is not going to be around anyway. So don't bother voting for him. That's a general strategy, I think, that the Democratic National Committee is going for, and the media will be completely on board with this. You can guarantee that.
Okay. So remind us who Maria Butina is.
Well, this is one of the tragic outgrowths of the whole Russia hysteria, the new Red Scare, the McCarthyite atmosphere that's overtaken the United States, which is in the wake of Hillary Clinton's epic loss to Donald Trump. Maria Butina was an international student who was studying in Washington, D.C., I believe, and she was a big-time gun advocate and was sort of getting in there with the gun lobby and going to the shows, very active in the sort of NRA circles, as it were. So eccentric would be maybe a word to describe her in that sense, not your normal Russian recent college graduate. But this is an excellent article here in the New Republic by James Banford, and it's called The Spy Who Wasn't. And in this article, if you have a chance to read this, it's absolutely stunning. This basically shows what a show trial this was, and the fact that they were looking for a scapegoat, and they literally made up accusations about her, presented as evidence. I mean, this is one of the biggest miscarriage of justices in the United States. And here's one quote from this article. The government's case against Butina is extremely flimsy and appears to have been driven largely by a desire for publicity. In fact, federal prosecutors were forced to retract the most attention-grabbing allegation in the case, which was that Butina used sex to gain access and influence in Washington.
Mike. Now, if I remember correctly, Patrick, the mainstream media was all over this and made a big deal of this sex to gain access story. Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing any retractions from the mainstream media.
I don't either, Mike. And, you know, the other thing that's horrible about this story was because they had hyped it up and made her into a spy in the press, they put her in solitary confinement right up to her sort of arraignment. And she basically pleaded guilty to some spurious charges, Mike, but after being in solitary confinement for a long period of time. So she was effectively, according to this article, tormented into confessing and giving the prosecution what they wanted. It's absolutely incredible that this would be allowed to happen in 2019, Mike, but unfortunately it has.
Okay, well, let's come back to the UK and our friend Gavin Williamson once again. And, of course, we were reporting on Monday that one of the things he wants to do is to develop a swarm squadrons of network-enabled drones capable of confusing enemy air defences. Sorry, confusing and overwhelming enemy air defences. Well, you'll be glad to know that the DSTL, the Defence the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory alongside the Air Force Research Laboratory from the US and in collaboration with the Wright Brothers Institute are inviting individuals and teams from across industry, academia and the general public to take part in a special hackathon to develop these drone swarms. Apparently this is, let's just briefly listen to what the DSTL is saying about it.
In Manchester on Saddleworth Moor and over in the US in California, the wildfires over there were just an incredibly destructive force. What we're looking to try and do is to see if we can use unmanned air systems, or drones as they're called, to create a live, up-to-date picture of where the fire is at any given time, so that the fire service or emergency service in general can work out how best to fight the fire and potentially save more lives. The fire service.
So apparently this is all about fighting fires, and yet Gavin is saying that it's for defence. Now, the other thing that Gavin was saying on Monday is that, of course, there has to that government can't develop AI-type technologies on their own. They're going to need to engage with the private sector. This is exactly what this hackathon is about. They're using the fires in California and Saddleworth Moor as the excuse, but clearly it seems that the intention is to move this into the military domain. I don't even know what to say about it.
Swarm and confuse, is that the
I think something's
the words he was using there. So I don't know, Mike. To intimidate the enemy, I guess they're talking about Russia, with swarms of little drones or big drones. I don't know.
It's not clear.
If you wanted to confuse the enemy, I think if they fixated a picture of Gavin Williamson's face on the front of each of these little drones and had them swarming, I think that would sufficiently confuse and dazzle the enemy into submission, Mike. But aside from that, I can't see it working at this point in time.
Okay, well, let's just mention briefly Yemen, because the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, alongside the United States Secretary of State, Pompeo, are meeting at the meeting of the Yemen Quad. This is the UK, UAE, USA, and Saudi Arabia to discuss the Yemen crisis, obviously, and this is happening in Warsaw later today. So they're apparently going to inject fresh international political momentum and support to the Yemen peace process and discuss measures to alleviate humanitarian suffering. How much truck do you put by that? Are they going to do anything to support the peace process? Are they going to do anything to alleviate humanitarian suffering? I suspect not.
I think the UK and the US and other stakeholders in the Saudi Arabian military-industrial complex, Mike, could have forced the peace process forward years ago, Mike, if they wanted to, and they haven't. So how long has it been? March 2015?
Yes.
So we're coming up to 4 years now. That's quite a long time, 4 years. But it's well within the power, Mike, of the U.S., the U.K., and their allies to have put this war to a stop. Certainly the fact that the Saudi Arabian military is using British, American, Spanish, other European countries using their gear, using their bombs, refueling in air, and so forth, being trained, now assist targeting systems, Mike. So I think this is a bit, looks like a bit of a show right now.
Absolutely. And of course, we have to remember that this is the war that the mainstream media has chosen to forget. It gets almost no coverage in the mainstream media at all. Why would that be?
Part of the reason, Mike, for that is because Syria has dominated the headlines for so long, and other stories have dominated the headlines. So it's given the media an excuse not to cover Yemen, basically. And there's been other various crises going on. I mean, Venezuela is in the news right now, Mike. It's got a lot more media coverage than Yemen has.
The reason for that, though, isn't it, is that the United States and the UK are particularly keen to see regime change in that country. In Yemen, they seem to be quite happy to allow Saudi Arabia just to continue with this war of attrition.
Yeah, because they're outsourcing this war on Yemen to Saudi Arabia, so they're clearly arming and equipping Saudi Arabia, training Saudi Arabia, so that it can play the role of regional enforcer on behalf of the United States and its allies' interests in the Middle East. That's clearly what's been going on for the last 4 years. So is this a pattern in the future, Mike? Will the U.S. and its allies be outsourcing their sort of strongman duties to regional hegemons like Saudi Arabia? Is that part of the U.S. grand strategy? And I've argued in, also in the past that, yes, that is part of the U.S. Pivot to its own hemisphere and to deputize, as it were, Mike, partners in various parts of the world to handle their you know, affairs and what their objectives are militarily.
Yes. Okay, now, just over a year ago, Matt Hancock was the Department for Culture, Media and Sport Secretary of State, and he stood up in Parliament and he announced the end of the Leveson Inquiry Part 2, and he said this, he subsequently said, the Cairncross Review will explore whether intervention may be required to safeguard the future of a free and independent press. So what we saw about a year ago was a complete 180-degree reversal from the attack by the government on the mainstream media via the Leveson process, to that Leveson process then being dropped, and also the Article 40 being dropped, which was the clause which would have required media to pay for court costs in the case of a libel, whether they won the libel case or not. So the government did a 180-degree change of position on this and decided that they suddenly needed to support and build some foundations for the mainstream media, because very quickly between 2011 and 2017, 2018, we saw the media losing its commercial footing, really. So he went on to say, I tremble at the thought of a media regulated by the state at a time of malevolent forces in politics get this wrong, and I fear for the future of our liberal democracy. So he was prepared to accept that the direction they were heading in is dangerous by perhaps offering some government foundations to the Fourth Estate, which is supposed to be there to hold government to account. So that recognition was there. Nonetheless, if you look back at the parliamentary statements that Matt Hancock made at the time, and you look back to other statements that he made, at speeches that he gave at other events, you find that what has actually come out as a result of the Cairncross Review, which was released yesterday, A Sustainable Future for Journalism, is pretty much exactly as Matthew Hancock had envisaged at the time. So you've got to ask the question, did Cairncross, did she actually carry out a review and come to conclusions of her own, or was she merely parroting an already established government line on this? Well, we'll come to that in a second. Now, let's just look at the main points. New codes of conduct rebalance the relationship between publishers and online platforms. And what she's basically saying here is that online platforms really need to start stumping up extra money for the mainstream media, because the balance has gone too far towards social media companies and not mainstream media companies. Mainstream media companies aren't able to develop revenue streams through social media, whereas social media is making billions of pounds and dollars. The Competition and Markets Authority is to investigate the online advertising market to ensure fair competition. Again, what the thing that Matt Hancock said a year ago was that in 2015, the mainstream media had been able to, for every £100 of print advertising revenue, had been able to generate, that in fact it was only able to generate £3 of the equivalent online advertising revenue. And so she is highlighting the fact that Facebook and Google in particular take the lion's share of the advertising revenue, and that needs to be redressed, perhaps through the Competition and Markets Authority. Online platforms' efforts to improve their users' news experience should be placed under regulatory supervision. So up until now, as we have said many times in this programme, and you've reported on the Sunday Wire and on 21st Century Wire, Patrick, Google, Facebook, Twitter and so on are all trying to find mechanisms for making sure that whatever news content is put on their platforms is legitimate news content, that it's not fake news. Well, in fact, she's arguing that this needs to be put under regulatory supervision, so there needs to be a regulator for that to make sure that the online platforms are doing that job very well. Next of all, Ofcom should explore the market impact of BBC News and whether it inappropriately steps into areas better served by commercial news providers. So this is to highlight the fact that many commercial news providers are complaining that because the BBC is state-funded and they produce what they describe as high-quality news, that in fact is unfair competition, and that the BBC News needs to perhaps support mainstream media in some ways. The BBC should do more to help local publishers and think further about how its news provision can act as a complement to commercial news. And in fact, they are talking about the BBC providing technological support to commercial news, particularly at the local level. But we already know, as Brian has been highlighting for quite some time, this issue of so-called local democracy reporters funded by the BBC. That model is to be extended. A new independent institute should be created to ensure future provision of public interest news. So we should just define public interest news, because one of the terms that Matt Hancock had used a year ago was this idea of high quality journalism. The report says ultimately high quality journalism is a subjective concept that depends neither solely on the audience nor the news provider. It must be truthful and comprehensible and should ideally but not necessarily be edited. You know it when you see it, but this is not a definition that justifies direct public support. So in other words, they can't really define this term high quality journalism, although it's right the way through this report. But this other term that they said was more important, public interest news. The quote that they give in the report is from the Centre for the Study of Media Communications and Power from King's College London. And they say it's not clear to us that the sustainability of high quality journalism is the primary problem for UK democracy and society. There could be a dearth of high quality film reviews, consumer product reviews or travelogues. Yet if this was the case, there is no evidence to suggest that this would threaten community cohesion, undermine public accountability and jeopardise democratic legitimacy. By contrast, there is evidence that a dearth of public interest news and information, especially reporting of public authorities, can have dire democratic consequences. So what are we talking about here? Really, this is apparently we're trying to define it in terms of news which actually holds public authorities to account. But as we'll see here, what this report is doing is making sure that the whatever public interest news there is only comes from particular news sources. You or I are not really entitled under this new system, as it progresses, to provide public interest news. But anyway, we go on. A new innovation fund should be launched, aiming to improve the supply of public interest news. So we're going to fund that sort of thing. New forms of tax reliefs, so more funding for the mainstream media. And in fact, they're talking about allowing media organisations to become charities and get the tax benefits of that as well. Expanding financial support for local news by extending the BBC's local democracy reporting service, and developing a media literacy strategy alongside Ofcom, industry and stakeholders. They're extremely concerned that the public are not media literate. They don't understand how to identify what is a credible source and what is not a credible source. And so they're going to develop a strategy with Ofcom, with the industry and with other stakeholders, whoever they may be, to do that. So Dame Frances Carecross said, the proposals I put forward have the potential to improve the outlook for high quality journalism. They're designed to encourage new models to emerge. Well, in fact, they're not, because what this is doing is all about shoring up the old model and making sure that it is sustainable, to use their term. Jeremy Hunt, who's the current Secretary of State for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, said a healthy democracy needs high-quality journalism, there's that term again, to thrive. And this report sets out the challenges to putting our news media on a stronger and more sustainable footing in the face of changing technology and rising disinformation. And I'm just going to end by making the point, Dame Frances Cairncross herself, well, her uncle, Uncle John Cairncross, was apparently the fifth man. So this is the fifth of the Cambridge spies. There's some debate about who the fifth man was, but he is certainly on the list of one or two people that it may have been. So that's just an interesting little aside. But I'm interested, Patrick, in your thoughts on this, because clearly the government extremely concerned and have been expressing this concern for over a year now about the state of the mainstream media and its sustainability. And it seems to me that I have a difficulty with a government that shouts about free trade and open free markets and that the markets will solve all problems for us on one hand. On the other hand, they won't let the free market deal with the media situation. And if the mainstream media is not providing the high quality news that people demand, then of course they're going to fail.
Yeah, I think there's a fear, Mike, a tangible fear of the marketplace of ideas, the free market of information. And this is something that's palpable with the establishment. This is why they've set up all of these different organizations and NGOs like NewsGuard or the First Draft Coalition, this endless amount of these so-called organizations to fight fake news and disinformation. The Integrity Initiative is a sort of souped-up fascist example of that. But go back to this slide by Mr. Wright, this last quote here, on his after Dame Frances.
Yeah.
The end of this quote is very telling, Mike. Jeremy Wright is saying that we need to basically have a healthy democracy, it needs quality journalism, et cetera, et cetera, in the face of changing technology and rising disinformation, Mike. And I have to tell you, I was preparing a presentation on this very subject, which I gave this past weekend in Norway, and I was collating a number of stories that had to do with fake news about Russia, or Russiaphobia, Mike. And I started collecting the stories. I started archiving them. And just from the last 2 years, the number sort of went, when I got over 100, Mike, 100 fake news stories regarding Russia from the Telegraph, from the Times, from the Guardian, too many from the Guardian, from the BBC, from the Express, from the Daily Mail, from CNN, endless. Endless amount of made-up, completely contrived, fabricated stories in major national, international news outlets, Mike. Over 100, okay? I could only present, I didn't have enough time, I could only show 15, 16 of them, okay? The collective impact of these stories, Mike, through the Washington Post, through the New York Times, through all of these so-called respected papers of record and major respected media outlets, the collective impact of that is massive disinformation affecting the public and influencing public opinion based on fabrications and lies. And so this is the output of these newspapers, these television, of the Integrity Initiative, Mike. And you don't hear a mention of this in any of these grand strategies and grand plans to rescue the decrepit state of the media. It's almost like they don't want to address this problem, Mike. And so the problem is, Mike, they're implicated in it. These media outlets that are advising government on these issues, that are advising Facebook, and they're getting advice from the Atlantic Council and the DFR labs. These are people actively involved in spreading disinformation, fabricated propaganda, Mike. So If that problem is not going to be addressed, then whatever they're cooking up here, I can guarantee you that it's going to have a huge amount of political bias baked into it. Just look at the way Ofcom is behaving in the last couple of weeks. targeting alternative media outlets, targeting RT. And so, you know, are they moving towards the Nordic model, Mike, where government funds media, where media can only survive with government funding? Well, if you look at what they've done to the arts, you look at what they've done to theater, and by sort of co-opting that section of the society's culture through funding mechanisms, and perhaps causing people to self-censor in this way if they're dependent on state funding, Mike. This is what will happen to media outlets, I believe, if this is going forward.
Well, I think that Matt Hancock had it absolutely right a year ago. He said that if we get this wrong, this is a major threat to democracy. It is a major threat to democracy. But the fact is they've already got it wrong, and the threat to democracy is already there. Whatever happened, I don't know exactly what it was, but whatever happened between the Leveson inquiry and today, something happened within the mainstream media, within at the editorial level, where a decision was made. This is clear that it's a decision was made at an editorial level that the mainstream media was going to follow the government line, whatever that was, and that's where we're at, because we don't see any mainstream media outlet contradicting any other mainstream media outlet on any issue, any major policy issue today anymore. It doesn't happen. There is no competition, no genuine competition between the mainstream media. They are acting as a cartel. They're reinforcing each other's narratives. They're linking to each other's articles. And so what this report does is it now gives potentially a financial underpinning to that cartel. So there's no requirement for a competitive market model here. They simply pull in the press releases from the from the government, and they republish them.
And so it's the same. We'll fund organizations we like that are comprised with board members who are people like us. Those will get support through an initiative like this, and they'll handpick a few young, up and coming, good, nice looking, trendy media outlets to sort of pose as the sort of left wing alternative media outlet website of the day, and maybe the conservative one as well. And so you have this very controlled conversation, Mike. But I don't see anywhere in any of this documentation, Mike, the word truth. It's almost as if they don't want to mention this word, because isn't this the point of journalism? It's the pursuit of the truth, to follow the facts, to follow the evidence that leads you to the truth. And instead, we get all this talk about, oh, disinformation, fake news. Nobody talking about getting to the truth. And we have debunked so many mainstream media stories, and we have presented evidence that is the truth and that hasn't been refuted, that runs counter to everything published in The Guardian, specifically looking at the issue of Syria. Okay, so who's credible in that situation? The biggest war story, Mike, in the world in the last how many years, and you have the most respected publications printing outright fabrications, total disinformation regarding Syria. We're printing the truth, and we're getting attacked for it by some of these organizations. So do you think that this is going, what they presented here is going to fix that?
No, and that's not the intention. Anyway, let's move on. We're going back to the United States now, Patrick.
Okay, so next. This is, well, here we are. Whatever you do, don't mention IPAC. So this is Ilhan Omar. She is a Somalian refugee and recently joined the U.S. Congress representing her state district in Minnesota, and she's also, as you can see, wears a hijab, which is very controversial. So she has been in hot water. So why? She has mentioned the word AIPAC, or criticized AIPAC, and that is the Israeli lobby in the United States. So let's take a look here at the tweets that got her in hot water. So Glenn Greenwald had tweeted that day talking about you know, what who's wielding the influence in the background? You know, who is influencing U.S. politicians? And she tweeted back, it's all about the Benjamins. So she's referring to Benjamin Franklin, the $100 bill. Okay, this was immediately jumped on as an anti-Semitic remark. So IPAC, if you're not familiar, it's the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. This is arguably the most powerful foreign lobby in the United States, and absolutely has an iron grip over both Democrat and Republican parties, but not just in Washington, Mike. Their influence extends to state and even local elections. So there's a lot of money to be spread around, and you can be sure that they do. And so here she's being challenged, you know, who are these Israeli influencers here? And she tweets back, IPAC. And this drew the eye of Mordor from the Democrats' coven leader, Nancy Pelosi, who basically charged Ilhan Omar with anti-Semitism for criticizing the Israeli lobby and its influence over U.S. politics, something that is a known fact in U.S. politics, as academic papers have been written on this, but someone dared to basically challenge that. So here is Omar. She's been forced to recant, and she's been forced to apologize by her party. So she issued this statement: anti-Semitism is real, and I'm grateful for Jewish allies and colleagues who are educating me on the painful history of anti-Semitic tropes. My intention is never to offend my constituents or Jewish Americans as a whole. And then she continues saying that we have to always be willing to step back and think through criticism just as I expect people to hear me when others attack me for my identity. This is why I unequivocally apologize. Well, she hasn't really done anything wrong, Mike. That's the problem. She hasn't made any anti-Semitic remarks. But what you can see here, Mike, is exactly what that was done by the lobby to the Labour Party in the UK and to Jeremy Corbyn, planting a trope that there's an anti-Semitism problem in the Labour Party. So the lobby is using the exact same techniques. It worked so well in Britain, Mike, they thought, well, we're going to try to roll this out large style in the United States. And that's exactly what's happened. So here is Ilhan Omar. She's been forced to prostrate at the altar of the great and powerful Israeli lobby in the United States. And Donald Trump even weighed in, saying anti-Semitism has no place in the United States Congress, Trump said during a cabinet meeting at the White House. And I think she should either resign from Congress, or she should certainly resign from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. That's what the president said about this. So as you can see, it's getting a little bit serious, but I don't think she's going to resign over this. She's actually held quite firm. She hasn't recanted her statements as such. Those tweets are still online, Mike. And it does set a precedent here. A lot of this is outlined very well in an excellent article by Tedros Fikri, who is the editor of the Gion Journal. And this is up at 21stCenturyWire.com. He talks about Omar's dilemma, IPAC, Zionism, and weaponized identity politics. Weaponized identity policies talking about the Jewish Israel and Israeli lobby and how they enforce this very strict party line in U.S. politics, Mike. So that's the big uproar of the week in U.S. politics. So we'll see if it gets as bad as it did for the Labour Party.
Okay, just a couple of items to finish. Then we'll just mention this one briefly, Patrick. So Jerome Rodriguez has lost his eye as a result of being hit with a plastic bullet during the Yellow Vest protests a couple of weeks ago. We mentioned that on this program with Vanessa.
It's official.
It is official.
It's official. He's lost the use of that eye. This was tweeted out by Ollie Richardson, who's been providing a few really good reports on the Gilets Jaunes events in Paris. So, so he's basically saying, don't expect Western human rights organizations to busy themselves with bringing Emmanuel Macron's regime to justice. They are only interested in offended homosexuals and feminists. So he's making quite a controversial statement there, Mike. Yeah. But he does, I understand the point he's making, is that that was a peaceful, unarmed protester, Jerome Rodriguez. Mm. who is, his life is ruined. So he's lost an eye because of the state thuggery by the French authorities, Mike. And so is that not an issue? Is this not a public interest issue? And he's just one of many, Mike. Yeah. Hundreds of French. In fact, someone just had their hand blown off this weekend.
Yeah.
If you saw that in the news, had their hand blown off by French authorities. These are peaceful, unarmed demonstrators who are exercising their rights and who are ended up being injured. And some, I think there has been at least one death that I know of.
Well, there have been, I think, 11 deaths so far, but none of them directly attributable to police activity. So the road accidents and other things associated with the Yellow Vest protests, but not directly as a result of police activity yet. So, but, you know, the way that they're behaving, it seems to me it's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
Okay, and we will end just by mentioning the passing yesterday morning of Lyndon LaRouche, 96 years old, a significant figure in politics in the U.S. for many, many years, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a person of note. He ran for president, I believe, on two occasions in the United States, and you know, he's been at the forefront of a number of issues. You can say that he has been very accurate in his analysis of a number of major geopolitical issues. And so he's definitely someone who I think has made an impact. Certainly in his alternative research community has been a political force and has driven a lot of issues to the surface, Mike, to the mainstream, and has actually had an impact on U.S. politics over the years.
And global politics and global economics, in fact, because, you know, they have been, the LaRouche movement has been campaigning for decades on this issue of the Eurasian land bridge and the New Silk Road. Really, this is the policy which China seems to be running with at the moment, with the Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road. They started talking about this in the mid-1970s. This report published in 1997. So you know, for anybody that isn't aware of the history, there's a lot of controversy about Lyndon LaRouche, of course, and a lot of lies also published. His Wikipedia article isn't necessarily 100% accurate, but nonetheless, if you aren't aware of the Eurasian Land Bridge reports, perhaps you should have a look at those and try to put those in the context of what's going on at the moment with respect to China.
One thing is he was deemed, Mike, as a threat by the U.S. political establishment at one, especially during the late 1990s or 80s.
Yes.
Sorry, and I believe there was they did throw him in jail.
He was put in prison with quite a few.
When George Bush Senior was running for president,
yes.
I think because they didn't want LaRouche. This is my reading of it. They didn't want LaRouche to be running for president that year. I believe that was 1988.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. It would have been around that time.
Probably, yeah. So they did not want LaRouche on the campaign trail, on a national debate platform, or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because for whatever reason, maybe he was just too well informed on a number of big issues at the time. Mm. So that's what many people believe. Certainly his followers believe that he was banged up to keep him out of the presidential race there, away from Poppy. But,
indeed. Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for joining us, Patrick. We will be back, as usual, at 1 p.m. on Friday, and I believe Alex Thompson will be joining us. So we hope to see you then. Bye-bye.